name is Gordon Kemp. I was born in Atlanta, Georgia, February 9th, 1925.
Okay, well, I'll do. All right, well, Mr. Kemp, tell me a little bit about your family. What kind of family did you come from?
I came from a dysfunctional family. I was made aware of my father when I was about 3 years of age. However, we had a very good relationship, even though my parents were separated. Came from a family of four. I am the youngest of that group. I came along during the Depression, and things were very, very bleak as far as employment. My mother worked as a domestic, making $7 per week, 6 days per week, sun up to sundown. Those were hours. My father was a chauffeur for a very prominent family in Atlanta. We made a fairly decent salary for that time. I don't recall what it was, but it sustained him and helped to sustain us. I dropped out of Morgan Hill.
Sure, yeah. Tell me a little bit about your education and that sort of thing.
I quit going to school because I felt that I didn't have the proper clothing the way I had other kids did. I dropped out of the seventh grade, went to work at Georgia Tech, washing dishes. I prepared washing dishes for about 3 or 4 months. The baker was absent one day, and I had been helping the baker in preparation of the breads and pies. And the food director asked me if I was filling in for him that day, which I did. The guy stayed out the next day. The third day, he had no job. I had $7 per week, Georgia Tech, making bread.
Yeah, how old were you at that time?
I was approximately 15 years old.
About 15. All right, you were the baker.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And after working there for a period of time, I decided I needed to go back and get some education. I went back to night school. I did not complete my education. I still did not complete all the grades required. After turning 18, I volunteered for the Navy. When I got home, I received my notice that I had been in. So that's how I got the choice of the service that I had to. I went to the Navy, and after reviewing my background, they made me a baker there. And I rose rapidly through the ranks because of my experience. Having stayed in the Navy for approximately 3 years, I was in charge of a group of blacks, many of whom were college graduates. The Navy was segregated. But I was in charge of I was a steward. I was in charge of the menu preparation, buying the food, cooking over the food. So I delegate most of my responsibilities. But in the evening, the guys would come into my office, and they would start diagramming sandwiches, working out break problems. And I thought to myself that here I am, with a very meager education, in charge of someone who has a college education. I need to go back to school. We had a library on board the ship. I read everything I could get my hand on. After being discharged from the services after the GED, I passed it. However, I decided I would go back to school, back to high school, and I finished the 11th and the 12th grade, which is A average. I applied at Morehouse and was accepted. Finished Morehouse in 4 years. Could have done so in 3 years if I had gone to see my advisor and all this kind of stuff. Uh-huh. But to make a long story short, I got married in the meantime. Uh-huh. And I had to work to school. I worked at a bellhop to build a hotel.
At which hotel?
The Biltmore.
Biltmore, okay.
Having graduated from high school, from Morehouse, we had three children in the meantime. And after that, I decided I wanted to teach them. I went to Thomaston, Georgia, and taught school there for a year, meeting another problem. I resigned from that position and accepted a position in Lawrenceville teaching. The pay was $150 per month in 1953. In 1951, Lockheed called me to come to work in October, the 3rd, I think it was. But I had signed a contract to teach at Thomaston the same day. So I decided I would honor that contract rather than come to Lockheed. My wife being pregnant in 1953, that was $150 for her and $158 for me. I knew we could not make it off of $158, so I reapplied to Lockheed, and that's how I come to it.
So now, okay, now you said you got called, now that means you had applied at Lockheed then already, when you got, you say Lockheed called you in 1950?
Yes, I had applied.
So you had applied. So what led you to apply for a job at Lockheed?
I heard some of my friends, all of whom were college graduates, and that's the only blacks they were hiring at that time. They had to have college education. And I applied, and I was accepted, and they sent me the telegram to come work.
And then you turned them down the first time, but then, so you reapplied a second time, and that was in 53, and then, so you were hired in. What kind of work were you hired into? What were you doing at first?
Structural assembly.
Structural assembly.
That was, but you had the first blacks who were hired in, you had to have 1 year of training to drill a hole and apply some fastening in it. You had to go to school for all this, read and print and all this kind of stuff. But this was not a requirement for white. They went directly from whatever the farm directly to the plane. But we as Carmichael said, blacks had no knowledge of how to build it. It couldn't be done by them. So we proved him wrong. It was a funny thing about all of the projects that we were engaged in. They were very complex. If there was any complexity, any problem, they would bring the blacks to that area to work the job out.
Were you in what plane were you working on at that time?
B-47.
Okay. In half section of B-47.
Right.
2113, I believe it was.
Right.
Let me help you out a little bit with some facts about the 50s. Lockheed hired as many people from Bell Aircraft as they could. When they came in here, they had to build up. It was a very rapid build up. And so they went out and recruited as many as they can. Of course, Jimmy Carmichael had been general manager. And so they did hire a lot of whites, because there weren't any blacks in skilled jobs with them. So you did have a lot of people. But everybody was given up. There was a lot of training. 2.5 million man hours of training. And the facts on all that the blacks got a disproportionate amount of training, primarily because of lack of industrial experience. Other whites had more industrial experience. And if a guy had been a structure assembler, with Bell, you could go right in as a structures assembler. So that's sort of
that wasn't true in all cases.
What do you mean? Some of them weren't experienced.
Directly from the farm.
From the farm?
Oh.
Okay. All right. They've given preferential treatment.
Yeah.
Yeah, I understand. And that was a time when preferential treatment was very popular.
And I could name you quite at least three or four people.
I had no really formal
education.
Well, they probably.
And they relied on these guys, and they were supervising for the right to interpret.
I understand. There was a lot of discrimination. There's no question.
So the policy was that if you didn't have the experience, you had to have the training. Mm-hmm. But sometimes even though the policy said one thing, occasionally it would happen.
Well, you got to keep in mind.
The policy in the whole program, though, mm-hmm. I was trying to get back.
Yeah.
Many guys, they were required at first, it was a few years training. Uh-huh. Then they cut it down to 6 months, in 3 months. Mm-hmm. And when I went in, 3 months. Mm-hmm. They carried, I was hired in one day, carried down to the training department for 3 hours. Mm-hmm. They called us on the floor to go to work. Mm-hmm. I know I didn't need training. Mm-hmm. Just put you with a buddy.
Learn by watching. You had to learn by watching what somebody mm-hmm. else was doing.
Those were very discriminatory times. There's no question about that. And you had managers and supervisors, as many of them as Lockheed could get from the Bell days. Well, but you also had others that came in there. You know, after all, you're a manager, you hire your son.
I'm not trying to put myself, paint my blue picture of myself, but every department that I was in, I was the most trained person in the room.
Mm-hmm. Didn't that benefit
you? No. Because I tried to prove something to a devout segregationist.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Uh-huh. He stated that no black could supervise for him. He was assigned the first.
Who was that?
Hoyt Parks.
Oh, my goodness.
You know him quite well.
You know, I'll tell you a story right here. I was in labor relations for 8 years, handled grievances and all 4 steps of the grievance procedure. Mm-hmm. And the same guys that gave us in labor relations a hard time, they were hard-nosed, and they had more grievances than anybody else. Mm-hmm. But the same guys who got EEO problems.
That's right.
When you say Hoyt Park, I can tell you a couple of them. But they were some of the best managers. See, that didn't make it right.
I admired that guy.
Did you?
Because to me, he was a self-made man.
Uh-huh.
He did not have a formal education, but he was a leader.
Mm-hmm. That's Hoyt.
Parks,
P-A-R-K-S, Parks. Hoyt Parks. Mm-hmm. And he was a white supervisor.
But I was going to prove to him that I could work for him, knowing his views.
Yeah.
I didn't have to retaliate in kind, but I was a thorn in his flesh.
Well, you know.
You were just going to retaliate by doing things he didn't think you could do.
That's true.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In doing this history, we are interviewing the white people. I've already named a few of them that we're interviewing. And there's no question about it, that at that period of time in North Georgia, there were very few people. They weren't prejudiced against integration and that sort of thing. So Lockheed had came in and they were working there. And later on, when Lockheed became a permanent fixture in the community, there were additional training programs for those people. Sensitivity training programs. The one we call was Build the People. Mm-hmm. Robert Gross, founder of Lockheed, made a speech and he said, build the people and the people will build the airplanes. But the Build the People program was definitely made for the white supervisors and managers to understand the nuances, I'm going to use the big word, working with a culture that they were not familiar with. And so we went through a period of time with, now, it never did get perfect. When I retired in 1988, it still wasn't perfect.
That's interesting. Tell me about what it was like working. Tell me a little bit about, you started off from where you started off. Tell me about some of the different jobs you did as you went along and how that happened and about some of your interactions with supervisors.
This is a very unique story, one I've never encountered before. Well, I resigned myself that I was just going to be a driller or a instructor or something. Mm-hmm. I resigned myself because of the culture. Mm-hmm. After immigration came about, they found a need to upgrade quite a bit of people. I had applied for maybe one or two positions. I was denied for what reason I don't know. But I accepted a position. I never had any experience. Well, I stopped drilling holes in Buckton Rivers and applied for a position in preventive control. I was accepted at stopping forecasting the need for the planning. Then they had found a need, since when the C-5 came on, they had to have quite a number of people, went up to about 34,000 or 38,000. And I was made an expediter, that is to trace the parts from its inception to the final installation and all that kind of stuff. Then they made me, no, this is the funny part. I enjoyed that job because it gave me an opportunity to really roll the plant to see the big picture. When, as before, when you boxed in, you didn't see anything, just that little area.
Yeah, understand.
And so, Pat Patterson knew that they had the EEOC. No, a black friend of mine, he saw me one day and he said, "Do you know that your name is on the salary payroll?" I said, "How can that be?" He said, "Well, they didn't use 12 salary." I said, "I don't know anything about it." A week later, I went to the restroom, and Pat Patterson just happened to look at my badge and give it to him. He said, "You're supposed to be salary."
Hourly badges for, and oval badges for salary and hourly for round.
Yeah. I didn't go to work the next day. I went downtown in the OC. I told them the story. Mm-hmm. And they get to see it. Looking at my background and all this kind of thing, mm-hmm. the job that I had. I said, "Let's go back and go see what kind of thing." Next morning, Bert Mason called me into his office.
He's a white manager.
He said, Pat Patterson called me the next morning to come to his office. He said, "I told you I was going to get you a job." Now, mind you, he had said I was supposed to be inside. He had not told me that he was just trying to cover up for whatever
happened.
Right. Happened. And I found out later what happened. But to continue, he said, "Here are 13 salary positions that you can choose from. You have a new job you want of these 13 positions." My answer to him, "Pat, if I'm qualified for those 13 positions now, why haven't I been qualified before? What are you trying to do, appease me or what?" He said, "Well, we choose it back for a little while." I said, "Okay, I'll accept it." I accepted a position in production control because that was the area that I was most familiar with. Now,
that's a salary position?
Salary position.
Okay.
Supervisor. But yet, there were 13 or 14 other people in the same position. They put us in match. Mm-hmm. And they formed a class just for these 13 people. We had to attend training for 4 months. Mm-hmm. And my view was, it was just a waste of time, all this stuff they were teaching. I knew all familiar with it.
And were these all blacks?
All blacks. Yeah. But when a white was made a supervisor or a manager, whatever, he went directly to work immediately. But we had to be trained because we got to interact with them. White people, you know, we got to supervise them, so we got to be very delicate in our dealing with them. Well,
so now this training, in the training, they would teach you to be sensitive to the white folks and not to offend them and not to,
they would take us to the high level meetings. You know, we would maybe have 1 or 10 in this meeting. No, we had meetings every day. And 1 or 10 of them, we would rotate going into meetings just to see how the big picture came into being. And at the end, we were required to write up a report on our, I said, never. But this has been required of other folks who are going to submission. I said, well, I would not do it. So I would define some of the other guys said they wouldn't do it. So finally, they just brought us up on the floor to supervise. After I had been in supervision for approximately 3 or 4 weeks, the shop steward called me aside and said, Gordon, I'd like to talk with you. I said, okay. We went up to the corner and talked and said, I just don't think it's right for a black person to supervise white folks. I said, I'm sorry you feel that way, but I can understand why you feel that way. But rest assured, you will be treated fairly, equally, and all that kind of stuff. I said, but just bear with me. We will make sure we'll get the job done. That guy came to be one of my best men.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. And I was instrumental in getting him a salary position.
This is a white. Senior chairman.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A group chairman, senior chairman. And do you remember what department that was in? He says production control.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. 11 something.
Now, who was the manager there?
Bert Nixon.
Okay.
Oh, no. Bert was what was that?
Fort Parks?
No. Bert Nixon was the manager.
He was your manager.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When you
he's still around. We're going to interview him.
Today. Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
I'd like to
see
you.
He's still around. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I know Bert.
Yeah.
When I get together again, we talk golf.
So now that was
his favorite pastime. that one thing you see.
Well, then, when you first went in there, let's get to the race relations part of this now.
Okay.
When you first met Bert, what did you think of him?
I was appalled at his requirement. The first statement he said to me, now you're in supervision, I want you to know some of my requirements for my supervisor. Okay. The first would be that you wear a white shirt every day. Like I had never been used to a shirt and tie. Having thoughts could be another and other situations. But really that was the thing that really got next to me. Mm-hmm. Like I, you know.
As if he, you know, had to tell you that.
Did the other guys wear white shirts? What else did you do? You have other requirements at the
No, at the moment, as I said, time is wasted. But that stuck out.
Did you feel like you could talk to Bert?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I felt like I could talk to anybody. Mm-hmm. I had soured my relationship with Lockheed because I felt like he was not getting a fair share of treatment, you know, equal treatment.
Okay. Okay.
I said, well, I just do a job because I can win it.
Well, and you say later on he became a friend. Bert Nation.
No,
this was the guy that worked under him. He was talking about originally that this guy that he helped get a supervisor position later, I think is
right.
What he said. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. What was his name? That's okay.
That's okay.
I was going to just ask. So this was with the C5. Is the turning point? That's when you came up. Now that was the.
That's October of 65.
Mm-hmm. So before then, you had been in this, basically doing a lot of this work, similar kind of work, only
right.
it was as an hourly employee.
Right, that's it.
Although you should have been in that, whatever, for the work you were doing, as Pat was essentially saying, you should have already been
right.
salary, is what he was saying. Mm-hmm. So you started supervising whites after you actually got on into a salary position. Before then, when you were doing it kind of without the title, mm-hmm. were you supervising whites before, or how did that work? Or did
well,
you, not technically, but
no, I was in an integrated group,
right?
And the group that I was called from,
uh-huh.
my supervisor was 20 years of age, and he had reviewed all of the everybody filing and all this kind of stuff. So he said to me, Gordon, you ought to be in my position. It's just not right. I said, well, just kind of. And got him by the name of Bell. He went on to become a manager and all this kind of stuff. But he did have some people, but he was fabulous.
Let me go back to when you came into production control from the center.
Mm-hmm.
You are an hourly employee.
Hourly.
You know what the classification was? What your classification was?
Yeah. Expediter.
You were an expediter. Okay. Well, that was a much better paying job.
What does that, tell me a little bit about what that is. What does an expediter do? Just what's their job?
To procure a shop order. Get the requirements for that shop order.
Mm-hmm.
You may have to start with, it all depends on what area of expedite you're in.
Uh-huh.
You may have to start from the raw material all the way to a certain point.
Uh-huh. But you're the guy who's responsible for making sure everything's,
mm-hmm.
you know, there, that everybody has what they need.
Right.
And
that group that you're servicing, you
right.
make sure that
they've got what they need.
In the beginning, when they had a total segregated assembly, mm-hmm. the B-47, they had position, and I understand from Harold Mintz that he had white guys running for white services.
Okay.
And they weren't blacks going over to other departments that were not integrated at all,
mm-hmm.
to avoid confrontation.
Right.
Apparently, now that was 10 years earlier than this.
So I'd like to give you a little
issue
around some of the, okay.
Sure.
A D stamp, that was a discrepancy,
right?
Something went wrong, or something, you did something wrong, somebody else did something wrong.
Right.
Well, if the blacks did something wrong and the assembly that the black built had gone over to an area where the whites were integrated with their functions,
mm-hmm.
if there was a D stamp or a discrepancy found in that unit or material, and the blacks were responsible. They had to go over to where the whites were.
Mm-hmm.
This is the kicker.
Mm-hmm.
The whites were allowed to vacate the area until the black finished their job. It may be one black person doing a job, may take them a day or two, which these didn't work yet.
So this was back in the B-47, this was on the B-47?
Oh yeah,
and so when y'all had the
center. And C-130 also.
Okay.
Well,
you
were going over into the white area, which would be the one C-130, wouldn't it?
Huh?
That would be the one,
yeah.
where the white workers are.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So what you're saying, if I understand it,
the supervisor or the manager would allow them, when I say them,
White
to vacate there, do whatever they want, until you got out of there.
Until you had fixed whatever it was, rather than have them continue on while you're in. I say.
Well,
it was just a sign of times.
It's a sign of the times. What do you think would have happened if it didn't do that? What would have happened? Did you have any experience to give you an idea of what it would be like if the managers didn't have the whites vacate?
Well, I just thought that was a waste of money.
Sure.
Yeah.
All right,
sure.
What would have happened?
Lost time.
What would have happened?
I really don't know.
Well, you know they thought something bad would happen.
Oh, yes. That's the reason.
But that...
In other words, attitudes were very strong.
Yeah.
So they moved these guys...
Just out of fear that something would happen.
And also, you may have had some white women over there.
Right, and some of these white workers may have suggested it to them. Said, I don't want to be
over here. That was another.
Sure.
I understand.
Now, that's interesting, though.
Not only like,
we
heard
And so that was in the mid-50s now, you're talking about.
It was even in the 60s.
Yeah. Okay. By that point, even though there was no technical segregation, there was still a lot of informal segregation. It just wasn't called that. It wasn't by, I understand. So there were still sections where only whites worked, even that late, even in the 60s.
Even if maybe you needed a fastener, such as a boat with wash of well, it was not available in your area, but it was available in somebody in the white area.
Uh-huh.
You had to get permission from your supervisor to get permission. And I you
go there. Oh gosh.
How long did that attitude last?
Well, at least 13 years of my experience.
Uh-huh.
So that would have been into the late 60s.
The late 60s.
And it began to change in the late 60s.
Working on the C-5, right. What did you do? Were you still in production control at that time?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Right, which was a
part of it.
Oh, you did.
You retired the same year Hugh did. So you were there from 1953 to 1988, and you got up to the rank of supervisor technically in 65, I guess, then or thereabouts.
Yeah.
And so, of course, you kind of hinted that you had been acting manager occasionally and that sort of thing, but never did you seek promotion to manager during that time.
I recall the EEOC was supposed to track our progress throughout our employment year. So it had been documented and all this kind of stuff. At least semi-annually, your manager would call me in and tell you how you were doing and all this kind of stuff. If you had any problems and all that stuff. And I recall the manager called me in one day and called for a party. And he said, "What is your aspiration?" I said, "To have his job." I don't mean.
Right. Oh, sure. I know what you mean.
Okay.
Have a job like here.
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. Not that he took it personally.
Right.
Okay. And I really thought I was going to. Especially after they started cutting back and playing off. I'm still the most qualified person, education wise and experience wise, of all the group.
Mm-hmm.
They never, I guess I was blackballed because of some of my antics.
They blackballed you and then whitewashed the fact that you
did.
Yeah, I was going to ask also, what did you know about this group in the mid-50s that formed, of African-American employees?
I knew all of them.
Uh-huh.
However, I was not made aware of their intentions.
Right.
Otherwise, I would have been.
Okay.
How was your experience as acting manager?
Good. I had a good relationship with the home.
Did you have white supervisors under you?
When you were acting manager?
Yeah.
You got along with them okay?
Yeah, I never had any problems.
Mm-hmm.
Except with boy. I knew if I had problems with boy, I could give you one blatant form of he would become upset if you were chosen to week, I jilted him.
He not took off.
And said, lo and behold, my other dog had a baby today on the year.
I took off.
Mm-hmm. Following that, I had jilted him. And would you believe it? About a month later, they called me the jury again.
Oh my goodness.
Oh my goodness.
I liked you on the jury. Yeah,
but here's what happened. Court found out that I had jury duty. And I went in to tell the secretary that, remember now, I'll be absent Monday. She said, well, he had your name. No information to do so. I will serve. I went back that Friday evening and I told him how to move here. And he said, your name is Dick. I said, I didn't take it off. I had it. I said, well, you know, that's wrong. I will serve. No, he said, between your wife, your children having babies and your children. You're serving jury duty. You can't come work here of late. I said, let me take you one thing. Well, if any member of my family is sick, or if I'm required to serve on jury duty, I will serve and I will take time off to see about my family. They don't know how to get anybody help. I said, I'm not seeking any help. We had some confrontation because of a discrepancy in an area that I inherited from another supervisor. They had an abundance or a surplus of parts that we had no need for. But I inherited that problem, so that was an investigation. And you may be aware of that. The plug, you know, those surplus plug they had. $6 million worth of clothes that we didn't need to have no need for. Filled up three box cars.
I heard that.
I did. Okay. And he wanted to me to share the blame. What am I gonna do? I inherited this. So he did something and I went down. Complained, and I told him, you know, about the confrontation we had. And I made mention of the fact of what he did the year before. And they used to see him.
So who was
what?
Who were you talking to?
I've forgotten who I was talking to.
Was this downtown?
No, just in this one.
That's plant.
That's plant. So what? Said, do you want to buy it now? I said, no.
I'd like to sure know who you're talking to.
I said, I just don't want him interfering with me on a personal basis. Okay. That was an incident I never forget. And then as a result, he made me pay for it.
How's that?
Withholding the money. You know, it was up to you.
Okay, come salary review time.
Salary review. I get to go and review, but the money was not didn't come. And on three different occasions, they had to go back and bring me up to the bare minimum.
Now, this is fourth part.
This is fourth part. I'm still trying to prove to him that I can work for him. I was a thorn in his side, but he took it out on me. But I would accept criticism from Fort if he's going to criticize the group. Okay, I can accept that. But one-on-one, I could.
Did you get any commendations?
Yeah.
From Hart?
Yeah. No.
Prior to when you were in Assembly.
Right.
So you were. I'm more familiar with assembly, you know, hand production control. Do you get any department awards in production control? Now you do in assembly. We have banners up there saying that so many hours, man hours without an industrial accident.
Right.
And of course, recognition sometimes for schedule and performance and minimum out of station work.
Right.
All those things come with. So when you work in assembly, it would seem to me that you, this is a question, you might have more good feeling about the results of what you're doing. If that's not so,
No, not really.
See, to be honest with you,
I got no satisfaction out of Pilgrim Bowl from that bad assembly.
Okay.
Because I knew I was.
You did more.
I could do more.
So now, when this, did you know any of the people who were complainants in this lawsuit? There was a lawsuit in the late 60s, I guess, right around 1971.
Yeah, he was saying that he did.
In fact, I believe one is still working.
He's going to try to find the name of that.
Oh, great. Wonderful. That would be great.
Let's go back a little bit before you came to work a lot. What your life was like. Where did you live in Atlanta? What section of Atlanta did you live in?
The Northwest section. Yeah. The Coca-Cola plant area.
Okay.
Where it's presently located.
That's Spring Street.
Right.
No.
That's North Avenue. And
you said the Northwest section. You mean Southwest?
Northwest.
Northwest? Mm-hmm. Is it segregated or what?
When you were living there.
Oh yeah.
What street were you on? Maybe I can.
Well, I can carry it back to the old bottling company. Marietta Street and Copper Street.
Oh my goodness.
They had about 5 or 6 tennis courts at the back of the building with about 10 or 12 foot chain link fences every weekend, Saturdays and Sundays. And the members of management would bring their wives and they'd all play tennis and they'd knock the ball over the fence.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how we made some good money. We'd free the balls and they'd give us a nickel or dime. Now that was good money back in the 30s.
That's the equivalent of the knot hole game.
Oh yeah.
I was the knot hole game. You could get that ball and you'd get into the game.
So when you lived, tell me a little bit about what it was like growing up in that area.
It was very, very rough. Very, very rough. Most people, most of the neighborhood consisted of Chapman County. I mean, Chapman County. So you would straight through the sea to York. Quite a number of stores owned by Jews that gave rise to some of my experiences. I have worn so many hats in my life, and you'll write a book about it.
Mm-hmm.
I've been a baker, a butcher, a bellhop, made of doll shoes, taught school.
You're talking about the Jews.
I worked for them.
Did you?
Mm-hmm. Did what capacity?
Some of everything. From cutting meat to packing foods. Food was now packaged in the likelihood. And I would imagine in some way
Now, this is when you were younger, when you were
tired of the way
teenager.
You know, driving, chickens were not sold, refrigerating was a premium. You got a chicken out of a cook. And even in the store, the Jewish store, you had carrot ones together, dressing.
So you bought a live chicken. If you went to the store and bought chicken, you bought a live chicken.
Yeah,
I say. Tell me, what did most folks do for a living around where you lived in your community? What kinds of things did people do?
Manual labor, digging ditches. Very few of men had jobs on the railroad, and they were considered as being good living. Every now and then you hear of one or two who have gotten on the post office. Very few of the teachers lived in the area the college students. Most of the area for women concerned, they were domestic. Or they did washing and ironing for white families,
right.
And all of the people at Tech.
Uh-huh.
And they'd go and get them, you'd carry them back, wash them, carry them.
So you had to go pick them up, and then you had to go take them back and all that, yeah.
We used streetcars.
Streetcars.
Didn't have any buses in those days.
Wasn't just
streetcars.
And
how'd you get to work?
Fair. It was 5 cents.
Yeah.
And it was a ticket. Yeah, like the movie tickets.
Mm-hmm. You had to get on the
back of
the back.
It wasn't back of the back.
Back of the street car.
Two doors.
Two doors. But
you never
it had a line.
Mm-hmm.
That was no turning around. A line one way, line the other way. A pole that went up to the low wire electric.
Right.
And then the seats were reversible.
Uh-huh.
Go down the line that the motorman would go down the line and turn the seat. So they got there, flip.
And then he'd go up the other end and get behind it.
The
wheel, whatever he is. The motorman, engineer, whatever it was. Right. He'd switch from front.
And if the street car was private, especially when you went into the white neighborhood, and you would see there up front, white one that seat, you had to move.
Okay.
And the motorman had the authority to arrest you.
So when you got to the end of the line, you might have to switch to the back of
you.
You'd have to get up and switch places, so you'd be in the right place. You'd be in the back rather than the front.
Did you have any problem with the motorman?
I've never been one to try to create any controversy. You do rules, I don't make them still. Not that you really accepted it.
Right.
You knew it was a way of
life.
Or you wouldn't live.
Right. What were the schools like, and what did people think about school
as
you were growing? What were the attitudes
toward it? I never had a new book in my entire life in my education experience. There were always students that the whites had used prior to, and I always had the writing, Johnny, Love, Mary, and all that books coming out, the pages coming out.
Sure.
They didn't have any new book, and
they
never carried a book home. They passed the book out every day in school.
Okay.
So that was up to me. And also, we owned school half a day. From 8 to 11:30, and then another group would come in from 12:30 to 4.
What high school did you go to?
Washington. First Black High School.
Yeah, I remember that.
What was it like? I mean, do you remember? Did folks talk about, or do you recall that there was an understanding that there was other, the white schools were different, were run differently, and were, was that understood?
Well, it was understood, but we knew what was going on, and we resented because if you were given some material and it was torn out of the book, mm-hmm. you were deprived, or you had to go and sit with someone else to mm-hmm. have to
read that page in the book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think what I'm hearing is that you were adjusting to what you really couldn't control.
That's it.
Yeah.
And you made a good life out of it, especially
well, yes, you could.
Best you could.
I really tell kids they don't really understand what mm-hmm. We had to undergo in order to get where they are.
Mm-hmm.
I think we did a pretty remarkable job with me going on.
Gordon, you're helping us to educate future generations.
Mm-hmm.
Randy's book, one of the first things a publisher does is sell it to all of the libraries in America. It's a good book, they'll all buy. So his book and what you're telling us will be a part of history. And young people coming along, and students of history coming along, will understand better what it was like. But we're dealing with the part of the history that has to do with jobs,
right.
as opposed to the quest for social equality, justice, civil rights era. Did not, civil rights movement did not get to deal with jobs. We got to deal with the law. The 6-4 Civil Rights Act, made it illegal to discriminate on race. Right? So, but that didn't produce jobs. The jobs had to be produced.
Yeah, I was going to ask you a little bit, if we could, I was just going to go back. I would just, before I forget about it, I was going to ask you, do you remember what ship it was you served on in the Navy?
USS Leedstown.
Leedstown?
Leedstown.
Leedstown.
We do have a retirement route from that ship.
Oh.
I served on another one, but that was the first one.
Uh-huh.
We put that one in commission
uh-huh.
when I got our basic training. A new ship was waiting for us.
Uh-huh.
New kid. Young kids had no naval experience and all that kind of thing. But they're bald and everything.
Uh-huh.
So
we
got that too. Segregated.
Yeah, the Navy was, yeah. The services were segregated during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Even though Truman, they should have known that.
Well, that was after the war when he.
Oh, that was. They didn't come
yeah, that was after the war when he segregated the armed services. And let's see. Something else I had forgotten.
Well, let me continue
yeah,
with
this. Yeah, Leedstown,
this Leedstown experience, we have a very, very active group, but most of us are down in Marines. But we've been together now for 13 years.
Mm-hmm.
We have a reunion every year
uh-huh.
in different cities, in just about every major city in States. We've had a group in New York, Atlanta, San Francisco, Chicago, St. Louis, Memphis, New Orleans. Anyway, there's
sure.
about a war.
Sure.
We have memorial service that they're doing. I think we've gone around the season of this. And we've known her now, oh, I guess about, I'm just guessing, probably another 50.
Oh, that's good. That's more than my World War II night fighter group. 14th Night Fighter Squadron that I was in, we had 13. And I'm going up to
well, But these are 30 active.
Okay, we're the same way. We got
but we have cars. We do cars from that twice a year.
Well, you're losing some every year. We are, and I'm sure you are, too. Let me go back to your ancestry. What do you know about your ancestry?
Bermuda.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very little. I can only go back to being my grandfather on my dad's side.
Mm-hmm.
My grandparents on the mother's side, they had deceased before.
Mm-hmm.
I can only go back that far.
that would be, your grandfather would be born sometime in the 1800s.
Right.
Do you know what he did?
He was very, very prosperous in the big world, in Wrightsville, Georgia. He owned a store. He owned Robin Kent. Quite a bit of land. The whites burned his store. Just about wiping out the country is assertiveness, a progress. And they decided they needed a school for the blacks in the area. And he spearheaded a movement to get a colored school, and once they raised the funds for the school, they built it and they named it after my grandfather, Doc Kemp High School.
What?
Doc Kemp
High School. In Wrightsville.
It is now, it will burn down again. The school would burn down by the whites, but they rebuilt it again. I think in 19, I'm not certain of the date. Either the 60s, they renamed the school to Lowndes County High School.
So that's been down in
Wrightsville.
That's where it's called now.
Herschel Walker.
That's right. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You're in a position. You started off life as an achiever. That's the way you understood the value of work. You had work ethic, which is lacking in America today in a lot of places, okay? And I see that, just looking at it from my standpoint here, as we look at history, that you had success and the times that others did not have. So what you're telling us, the story is the story of a person who coped with what he had to cope with and made the best of it. Not everybody did that. Do you have friends that did not do that?
Oh yes.
You know that.
In
the
capsule, thank you. I feel that I could have done more if I had really applied myself to a way left.
You think you could? Well, you're in a position that you dealt with the race relations thing right from the beginning. Mm-hmm. You knew what you worked the system. So this question is maybe not really a fair question, but did you see any change in race relations from the time you started to work with Black people? And I'm not talking with you. I'm talking with for Black people.
Jim.
Did you see race relations getting better?
I do. I really do.
And what's that?
I took that to education.
To education?
On both parts.
Uh-huh. Right. Well, you have a matter of intolerance, though. Intolerance. Jim Crow culture was a culture of intolerance. Mm-hmm. I don't want to see, work with, touch, marry, I'm not, again, tolerate that, right? And we know that. And our history is going to cover that. We're going to cover that real good. Somewhere along the line, we came from point one to point seven, I think. Wouldn't you say? Something like that. I'm not putting words in your mouth. I'm trying to get you're in a position to evaluate the improvement in race relations. How would you give any other words there?
On a scale of 1 to 10, I would say we were point 7.
Uh-huh.
Probably
And you started out
at a negative one.
Regulations, there were no relations.
Zero,
no respect.
Zero tolerance.
You don't fall in the category, it seems to me. I keep putting words in your mouth, but I don't want to do that. Was there any apprehension when you first, you heard they were hiring black people, and you said that the people worked for the railroad?
Well,
that was a good job.
Yeah, in those days. Right. Well, this guy, he came to visit me. He was a classmate. We went to school together. He said, I got a job. I said, where? He said, Rocky. I said, what are you doing? I don't know. I got a good bell phone.
Uh-huh.
I said, well, right now they're paying us to go to school.
Did you notice, or was there any apprehensiveness on the part of blacks about applying for a job at Lockheed or someplace like that? In other words, was there any, was there a sense that, or a fear of that, okay, look, there's no point in us going over there because they're not going to hire us, or because...
I had some apprehensions. When we first went there, they had a black personnel rep.
I know what you're talking about,
but I can't block.
All right, go ahead.
Okay. We know what happened about him.
Yeah, we got to talk about that.
He took his place, the guy took his place, and he left there and went to teach at Carver High School. You know what I'm talking about?
I think so. I can't think of his name.
I had all the qualifications for the job.
Okay.
I applied for the job. They abolished the job.
Oh, is that right? Well, tell me about Bob Kemp.
well, I think you might recall Spade.
Okay.
He was flaky, I think he was.
Did they get that?